just get this going here and I'll hit record.
Okay, so if we could just start out by having you say your name and who you are.
My name is Andy Imutan. I was one of the vice president of Cesar Chavez in the early years of the strike of the union organizing. We started the strike in Delano, September 8, 1965, and then we went to see Cesar because the Mexicans were crossing the picket lines, and the organization was predominantly a Filipino organization. There were, I think, about 3,500 farm workers at that time who struck. And we went to see Cesar, and he told us that his organization is not a union in the sense of a labor union. It was a credit union. But however, he told us that that he was going to meet with his staff and tell them about what's happening, because we wanted him to help us with the Mexicans that were crossing the picket line. Well, about a couple of days later, he called up, and that's the time also that Gilbert was talking about. He saw us going there. And they decided to join the strike. And on September 17, I think it was, or 16, 17, I think, the group of Cesar Chavez came in and said, well, can you accommodate us with your breakfast because we don't have any money? They had only $80, I think. So that's it. And that's how it all started.
But there was some build-up to that moment. Can you talk a little bit about organizing Filipinos, farm workers, and how... what they were like when you first sort of got involved with talking to them? What was their state and what were their conditions like when you first got involved?
Okay. Sometimes in August, I guess, or July of 1965, I attended the meeting that was being conducted by Larry Itliong. Larry Itliong was the Filipino organizers of the AWOC. AWOC, AFL-CIO. He was one of the organizers. And I was listening to the deliberation in the meeting. And I said, I said that America is supposed to be fair in dealing with their laborers and everybody. I thought when I was in the Philippines, I thought that, what do you call that? United States lead in everything, actually. And I thought there was equal rights to all the workers. Unfortunately, it wasn't. I was feeling, every time I listen, I feel more upset. And I said, well, No bad working conditions, and they were telling about being sprayed with pesticides while they are working, very low wages. They were not included in any labor laws that were being passed at that time. They were not, there was no, like the, what would they call this, Agricultural Labor Relations Board, which came later during our time already. But at that time, this was the the National
NLRA.
Mm-hmm. And the farm workers were specifically exempted from those. And then they were talking about the anti-miscegenation law, which actually were supposed to be, targeting the Chinese, the Japanese, and the other Mongolian races, Orientals. And when a Filipino got married to a white, you see that anti-miscegenation is not allowing the Orientals to marry white because they said it will produce Mongoloid children or something like that. So That is why you will see 80% of the Filipinos that were still around at that time, single men, because they were not allowed to marry under the law. Of course, some of them, as I said, were able to go home and got married to very young women. And they were all 50, 60 years old, went back to the Philippines, got married, came back with, and produced probably one or a couple of kids. And the children would not be able to really, I was talking to one of them and he said, I didn't know whether to call my, to present my father as my father or as my grandfather. That's how bad it was. But then again, so I was listening to all of that things. And I said, well, how come? I said, why? And then so I told Larry, I said, Larry, boy, this thing is getting me, you know, very bad and I'm feeling very bad about it. And anyway, you can count on me in case anything happens. I'll probably would like to help you in every way I could. So every meeting there was, I was there. I was listening, and the more I listened, the more I got upset. So when this track, right away, Larry and I were together, you know, already, we're kind of friends. I said, Larry, I'll be in. So that's what happened in the early years.
Can you describe the actual strike itself, like the first day, what happened,
yeah, okay.
What kind of events occurred around the strike, and what company it was, and, you know, how they made that decision, and what actually happened on those days?
Okay. Well, let me talk about, previously, there was the AWOC struck the Imperial Ballet, Coachella, and they had a 10-day strike there. And it was real rough. It was violent, and a lot of trucks were overturned, a lot of properties were damaged, a lot of people got hurt, went to jail. So on the 10th day, Coachella is, you know, that's where the first grips come from, going to the East Coast and to Chicago and all those places. So they, on the 10th day, the growers decided to talk with the union and give them what they wanted. They were demanding $1.40 an hour plus 25 cents a box as bonus.
And how was that different? What were they getting before then?
$1.10.
So
and they were asking for $1.40. And that was still the lowest and you know, farm labor is one of the most difficult thing that anybody can, and in fact, no white would want to be in a farm work, except probably in the early years with the Okies and very early years. But during our time, during the time of the grapes already, there was very seldom you can find a white person working in the field. So anyway, that's what happened in Coachella. And so they decided to strike. And
could you talk about the violence, like what those altercations were about? Did the growers hire people to perpetrate the violence, or did strikers violent too?
You said there was, you see, there were people crossing the picket lines. And the strikers who were picketing were very upset about that. You know, it's the usual tendency of people to get upset about something like that. And there were trucks overturned, and there were rocks thrown, and all that kind of thing. So a lot of workers were jailed. And that was part of the negotiation, I guess, with the growers that later on did not come up with a contract, with a written contract. It was just an agreement, and the growers agreed on the 10th day to give to the demands of the workers of $1.40 an hour and 25 cents a box. Okay. So AWOC was organizing with Larry in Delano. When that was over, The same kind of group of people that were working in Coachella moved towards Delano. And naturally, they wanted the same deal as in Coachella, and that is the reason for that meeting that they had. And the demand was the same, $1.40 an hour, 25 cents a box, better living condition, working conditions in the field was very bad. There were crews that were only drinking from one cup for the whole crew. Water, you know, just one cup all day long. And also, there were no toilets in the field. So there were women working. Very, very sad. And that is what they were talking about.
Yeah. Were the workers... Do you want some water or anything?
No, please.
Were the workers at that time predominantly Filipino in the grape fields?
Because the Filipinos, you know, dominated the table grapes. In other words, they have been there year to year, and they work in a crew, and so they go back to the same growers year to year, and they're experienced in packing grapes, because packing table grapes is a very delicate operation, you know. You have to do it right, otherwise the grapes may spoil.
What was it that they brought with them from the Philippines that enabled them to get so organized so quickly and to sort of be really firm about their demands? It seems like other groups hadn't had so much success, but it's been said that the Filipino farm organizing was some of the most stringent and militant and strong.
That's true, because, you see, in the early years, there were a lot of come-ons in the Philippines, that there's... A lot of work in the United States, good pay, and all that. So the young Filipinos who wanted to earn money began to flock and came to the United States. They came here. And so when they arrived in the United States, most of them didn't know how to speak English, you know. And it was difficult because they didn't know how to speak English, they didn't know how to read and to write. Quite a few of them. Most of them came from remote places in the Philippines. So when they arrived, they didn't have winter clothes, so it was a difficult situation. But the Filipinos in the Philippines, for example, they come from different groups of, well, Filipinos are different dialects,
different islands,
and so on. Yeah. So when they came, the Ilocanos, for example, got together and become, you know, a group there. And the Visayans also grouped together because they can communicate with them. So what happened was that because they cannot speak the English too well, they decided to come up with somebody who can at least manage to say something, get a lot of guts, you know, and be able to manage to speak a little bit of English and negotiate for them. And so that's how they work in groups of crew bosses. There's a crew boss and a group of crew. And they have a crew that continue to be together. And the crew boss's job was to negotiate and talk to growers and make sure that the people are working the whole year round or whatever. And a good crew boss should be able to maintain his workers in a manner that they are satisfied with the way he helps them. During off-season months, for example, they may need some money. They can go to the crew boss, and the crew boss will give them some loan or anything like that.
So the crew bosses ended up being the labor organizer later on because they had already had a relationship with the workers?
Okay. That is why I am very... adamant about this, because there the crew boss, the Filipino crew boss, is entirely a different breed than the Mexican contractors. The Filipino crew boss is like the father of the family. He takes care of his crew, otherwise he's not going to make it. The next year he will not have anybody working for him, because, you know, they are very, it's not like that. They get into a close-knit, and he should take care of his crew all the time that they need his help. And that's how he's maintained. And in fact, AWOC was organized because of the crew bosses. The Krobosses were the ones that were first organized by the organizers. And when they began to believe in what the AWOC was doing, then the crew followed. In other words, he was the first one who paid his dues, the Krobosses. So that's how it was in those years. And they had to, the Filipino organizers know that very well, that if the Krobosses will not cooperate, he cannot organize. So the Krobosses is the one that he organizes first. And in fact, some of the people in AWOC were Krobosses.
How did you get involved? I know you went to that meeting, right?
I just arrived from the Philippines.
You just knew, you saw this cause, and it spoke to you.
Okay, I just arrived from the Philippines.
What part of the Philippines are you from?
Manila. I was a realtor, broker. And when after I listened to all of this, I forgot about real estate. Because I thought that, well, this will need my involvement. The urgency of that situation is where I was needed. And I feel,
You were a leader. What was your main role there? Were you a visionary or were you a strategist? What kind of a...
Well, in the early years, I was just, just helping AWOC, because Larry and I began to become very close, and we used to talk about so many things, like how he lost his finger, because Larry had only 7 fingers. He said the train ran over his, when he fell, during that time they were tramps, sort of tramping around. They would ride the train, and in his case, he said he lost his balance and landed on the rail, and the train ran over his 3 fingers. That's what he told me. And it's a good thing when that happened, there was some Samaritans, he called them, a married couple who were white, who took pity in his situation and I think took care of him. And he could not forget that. He was always talking about that later on. So Larry and I became very close. And when he went to Stockton, for example, to collect dues from the workers and the Krobosses, and then at the same time after he's collected, he will negotiate with the growers the rate of wages for the workers, and then he will talk to them, and the workers said, "Oh, that's fine." So they work. Otherwise, they will sit and not work. And we used to go to do that in the early years, because he was an organizer for the AFL-CIO. And when he collected those dues, he would turn them over to Weber Street. That's the AWOC's headquarters in Stockton. And then he would get his pay and so on, and then we would go back again to Delano.
So you had some good road trips together, huh?
Yeah, together. So we had a lot of, we talked a lot.
Yeah, got very close.
And we got very close. And he told me he was involved with the strike in Alaska and all that kind of thing. But Larry was pretty tough. But he was also kind of not in favor of violence, I guess. Because when we struck, he didn't want the people to go into violence, for example, breaking windows of cars and so on. That, although in the early years, it happened because of temper, And of course, that was a good strategy because, of course, you don't have to pay damages as what happened in Coachella. And so that's what happened. In the early years, Larry told me, well, why don't you go to the Bay Area and fundraise and all that? So when I went to the Bay Area to do Larry's instruction, I went to Jack Henning, the Central Labor Council president of the AFL-CIO, And he gave me his small desk there and he said, okay, you talk to the unions. And he sent out a memo to them to expect me and, try to help me whenever I wanted. So I talked to the unions and asked for contributions to the strike. And they will respond very well at that time. So that's why my feeling is always, I'm very soft with the union because I feel that they are very helpful to us, you know.
Have you ever had a group of Filipino farm workers come up and thank you for your work and tell you that you meant a lot to their lives because you helped them? I may imagine you did, but.
Well, see what happened is that I have been given a lot of assignments in the union. When we marched to Sacramento, for example, I led the Filipino volunteers because Al Green, the head of the AWOC, did not agree to us marching with Cesar Chavez because he said, unions do not march. That's what he said. We are strikers, we strike, we break somebody's head, but we don't march. That's civil rights, you know, that time. But he said, well, I told Larry, it's up to you because I'm not being paid by the FBLCIO or anything. I'm not an organizer, paid organizer. And so we are going to march. And there were about probably 20 of us, almost 20 Filipinos who joined the march. That was the first time we talked with Cesar, you know, more. Because when we heard about the march, you see, we were not organizers of the march. We were just invited to attend if we wanted to. And we did.
Yeah. See. Talk about the connection or what happened and changed between Filipinos and Mexicans, because there was a lot of tension at first, but Cesar and you sort of changed that.
Correct. In the early, you know, that's why the growers were able to rule without question the fields, because he will, intrigue one group against the other. They will say the Mexicans are dirty Mexicans and they are lazy and all that kind of, and you guys are good, you know, and all that kind of thing. So they were successful, huh? Because they will tell the Mexicans the Filipinos are homosexual, some of them. See, they are not married. That kind of, you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So that they were successful in getting us, getting the Filipinos and the Mexicans really suspicious of the other. Although, once in a while, a Filipino will go and marry a Mexican girl. Although, under the anti-miscegenation law, they cannot even do that. Because the Mexicans were categorized as white. See? So anyway, that's what happened in the early years. There was a lot of intrigue. And they were successful.
Didn't they use Mexicans as strike breakers when you were on strike?
Yes. No, the Mexicans themselves, when the Filipinos went on strike, the Mexicans themselves didn't care, you know, whether... what if there was a strike or anything, and they will cross the picket line, you know, and they were scab on us and same thing. And when they went on strike, the Filipinos also will cross the picket line because we didn't have any respect for each other. We didn't care. But when this happened, and we talked to Cesar, and Cesar came with his contingent of, and he was able to communicate with the Mexican workers, it became a different story. See. The growers began to really worry, and they really became also very angry with us. Because in the beginning, the Filipinos will not picket the grower. Because he says, that's my boss for the last 20 years or 30 years, and I don't feel... But the grower never knew what his name was all the time. He says, boy, boy. And they were old men already, and they were being called boy. So when we begin to realize that the Mexicans were also good people like us, you know, they have also the same kind of dream. They are also human beings, and they are not lazy as what they... It was a different story. And we fought with the same cause, and Cesar Chavez was shouting, Welga, Welga, over there in the field. And then the Filipinos began to join the Welga, Welga, too, see? But what happened really later on was that the Filipino old men became the stationary picket lines. Back and forth in the front of the different ranches. And they begin to realize that it is not, no matter, he didn't want to picket before, later on, it became a routine, and he began to like it, see? He was in the picket line every day to mix. He was feeling, you know, that feeling when you are in the picket line that there is some kind of feeling that you are trying to fight for, not only for yourself, but for the entire Filipinos or workers in the field. For the entire workers in the field, that is what you're fighting for. When we marched to Sacramento, we were only 67. Although when we went out of Delano, we were called all kinds of names, communists, dirty Mexicans, whatever, go, don't come back anymore, you know, by in the, when we went through the main street. But when finally we reached Sacramento, that was a long, by golly, I cannot forget that because it was hot. And when we reached Sacramento, we were more than 10,000 people entering Sacramento.
Did you pick up people as you went along the field?
As we went along, people began to support the march. And they begin to be, I guess, the Chicano people, the Chicanos in the different towns that we went into begin to have developed courage, and they begin to come out also with us, you know.
Strength in numbers.
Yeah, strength, and begin to help us. And in fact, the churches were also there to, you know, to help us.
What do you think it was that got you guys talking to each other, the Mexicans and Filipinos? Was it only Caesar, or was there something else going on?
Well, we begin to have, you know, we eat together. For example, like in the strike kitchen, and we begin to talk to each other. We begin to talk about. We didn't begin to drink with each other. We begin to be in the picket line. When you are in the picket line, and people fighting for the same cause as you have, you begin to come up with, you know, you begin to say, well, this guy is my friend, see? This guy is my brother, and we begin to call each other brother because Caesar started that. We all started that. We call each other brother. Hey, brother, you know, that kind of thing. And we not only call each other brother, but we acted like brothers, really, all the time.
You look out for each other.
Yes, and then when we were later on, when we were sent out to boycott, for example, we stayed in the same house and we ate, that's it. And whoever is the leader of the group, no matter whether it's Chicano or is what, we follow. That was the...
Yeah. When people talk about farm worker movements, they often remember Caesar, but they need to remember you too.
Well, that's the sad part of all of this. That's why, because I was absent from the scene for a while. I did not, of course, the Filipinos that was with us, the strikers at that time, are all gone, dead, died. Some of them, I think, there are only two or three left. But we created for them the Agbayani village in Delano, which is through our effort with discussion with Caesar after the union contracts were signed. We thought because the Filipinos, the growers did not want any more camps. We said, if you want a camp, you pay for it, see, something like that, because before it was free. So we thought, well, at least we could give housing for the elderly strikers. And that's what we did. We gave them Agbayani village. We built the village. And they're all gone. Died, all of them already dead.
Because they all came here in 1906, right?
They came here in 1906, and they were already kind of 18 years old and all that. You know, you cannot live forever anyway.
Too bad.
Somewhere along the line, they've got to go, and that's what happened to it.
When you look over this whole life of yours, which a lot of it was spent doing this work.
I was going back to what you said regarding how the Filipinos, the Filipinos, for example, with Caesar, they loved Caesar very much, really, because Caesar was the kind of person that was sincere to them, and they, you know, Caesar went out of his way all the time to say, "How are you, brother?" and talk to them and like that, and embrace them and that kind of thing. And they really liked it. I mean, you know, they didn't have any family. So they all died. You know, when they came to the United States, they were poor. When they died, they were as poor as when they came to the United States. And that's how many years? 50 years? Working hard? And still were as poor as when they came in? All they had was a small, was their clothes and that kind of thing. No family. Nobody, you know, some people are trying to avoid the issue, putting them under the rug. But this, I want to talk about it because it's unfortunate that the whole generation of people were subjected to the anti-miscegenation law, which was the cruelest law that any human being can ever devise for another human being.
Consigning them to loneliness their whole life.
And there were 100, they had to give them a quota of 100 Filipinos to a Filipina. And then eventually they excluded them from the immigration, when in fact the Filipinos were under the United States and the Filipinos were considered nationals of the United States. And during the war, the Filipinos fought very hard for the Americans, you know that.
Yeah.
And so on. So anyway, that was why every time I think of it, that's why only the crow bosses were fortunate enough to, most of them got married, but not most of them, quite a few of them got married and had children. And that is the reason why I told you a while ago, the son or the daughter will think, I'm playing with my grandpa or my papa.
Mm-hmm.
Very sad.
Yeah.
And that is the story I like to convey also, that not only for the Filipinos who went on strike in Delano, but for why? What happened to them? What happened?
These are people growing our food too. I think the country owes people something better than that too.
Yeah.
Have a life, you know.
Yes. They were entitled to life, to go on, and they cannot even own land in the United States. There's so many things, very sad, but if you will go into that kind of in that kind of situation of the Filipinos, you will really, really wonder how come the United States, supposedly the leader of the leaders or whatever it is at that time, had thought of just of that kind of thing, anti-miscegenation law, how a cruel law, targeting a group of people, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Koreans, and of course included the Filipinos later on, because when a Filipino got married in L.A. to try the law, anyway, I don't know what he did. He got married, then they had him arrested, see? And he said, I'm not an Oriental, I'm a Malayan, the Malayan race. The Filipinos are of the Malayan race. And the judge says, including Malayan. So he has to...
Being arrested for getting married is crazy, but I think there are some people now who would recognize that too, that people who...
That's why you see how far it is, the older men, and then all of a sudden you see the older men are gone, but you see again younger generations. Where did they come from? Most of them came from the Philippines, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are a few, of course, that are American-born, married with mm-hmm. father who were here for quite a while.
My sister-in-law is from Manao.
But there is that, yeah. First, second, there's no such thing as the second generation.
Right, there was just nobody to have kids.
Nobody had kids, none.
Yeah, so.
Well, the Japanese different, the Chinese different. Of course, we had their women and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to add that people really ought to know about this history that maybe is being forgotten right now that might help us understand what's now going on with immigration law and our next series of follies we may be about to commit as a country? What can history teach us about not doing that again?
Well, I want to avoid that discussing that portion of the immigration law because it's too complicated.
But I'm saying that back then there were a lot of things that happened that we might want to remember now, not necessarily related to Congress at this moment, but that we might want to think about.
Well, For example, as long, the way I look at it is that as long as it is not the kind of situation where the farm workers are being exploited, because if there are so many workers and undocumented workers or whatever it is, there is really that tendency to exploit, because if you are an illegal, you cannot work openly, and you can be paid under the table, some, you know, with little amount of money and that kind of thing, and you'll be satisfied otherwise compared to where you came from. And of course, talking about that, it's also true with the Filipinos who come here as tourists, and then it is better here, of course, than in the Philippines, because in here they can make some money, more money, if they want to. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, because of the very tight laws sometimes, the Filipinos are made to go underground. They are not legally here, mm-hmm. so they are illegally working somewhere. Mm-hmm. But again, that's human nature, you see. They came here because of problems in their country, and here it's so open, and they give you better opportunity and wages and that kind of, you know.
Yeah.
But as far as discussing the whole, I'm not in a position to really get into that, because it's too complicated.
It is, and it's not what this story's about. We don't want to get all embroiled in current politics. I really want to talk about the history. Mm-hmm. But you've said a lot of important moments that we can include in the story, so thank you.
Yes, for example, the Philippines, right now there's a lot of shortage of nurses, and the Philippines has got a lot of nurses crowded with nurses in the Philippines, mm-hmm. but they cannot come in because they've got to go through this hard thing.
Process.
But then again, that's part of the country's way of stopping illegal to come in.
One more question. What do you think the enduring legacy is of the time that you spent as an organizer in terms of the Filipinos, in terms of where the union is today, the Farm Workers Union?
I don't get it.
What do you think you contributed to the current union? Like that, what is still there about what you set up back in those days that you can still recognize and say, it's still going, it's going to keep going?
Yeah,
and we did that.
You know, for example, after the March of Sacramento, there was the merger between our organization and CESAR's organization, which became the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee, FBLCIO. And out of that merger, CESAR was appointed as director. Larry Itleong was the assistant director, and there were five of us who were vice presidents. I, Dolores Huerta, Julio Hernandez, Gilbert Padilla, and Philip Veracruz. So when that happened, we just sort of became one organization, and so Cesar became the director, naturally, all directions of where, what we're gonna do, and our energies, and he was the one that's trying to do that. I was assigned for later on after, then he went on a fast. When he fasted the first time, then after the fasting, we went to LA to campaign for Robert Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy got killed in the hotel there, Admiral Hotel. So then we were assigned to go out in the boycott. We decided that the strike in Delano was not doing its thing, you know, picketing, shouting, Wilga, come on, get out, come and join us, was no longer, after how many years? That's 3 years already shouting there. So we decided to go on a boycott, and everybody was given an assignment where he was assigned, and I was assigned to Baltimore to go to Maryland, take care of Maryland's boycott, and Dolores went to New York, and Gilbert, I think, went to Philadelphia, and so on. And so I went to the East Coast to do to handle the Maryland boycott. Then later on, Dolores came back to Delano. I was assigned New York and in charge of the entire East Coast boycott. And that's how it is, that the role of the Filipinos, we were in the picket line, they were also in the boycott, they were in the kitchen.
Was there a large East Coast population of Filipinos that you could organize?
When you are organizing a boycott, you don't go into a distinct group of people, you know. You go after all the people,
everyone
that you can talk to and convince to support you and get them into your picket line and then also to do things for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. We did that. And we were successful in that because at that time, little by little, you know, we were able to come up with different kinds of approach to the boycott.
Yeah, and you got some contracts with very large growers at that point.
And then the growers decided that they have enough, you know, because they, for example, in New York or in Baltimore, when I was or New York, for example, in 5 minutes I know where there was a grape, and then we will be there with the people picketing it, and so the managers of those stores said, well, forget about it. We don't want any table grapes here.
So they would only take the union grapes after that.
So that is where they are selling it for a good price, see, in the East Coast and Chicago and Middle States. And so finally, one day, they decided to quit. They said, okay, Cesar, you win. I was in New York and I got a call and said, we won. They are now signing the contract.
And that was which company that signed first?
Guimara was involved. There were quite a lot of people at the same time, a lot of growers in Delano. I think all of them.
Do you think they got together and said, okay?
Okay, well, that's it.
That was the Western Growers Association. They got together.
So all the growers in Delano anyway, table grapes. Mm-hmm. We were the table grapes growers. And I think in one day we had about 56,000 members. We all started with less than 100. I mean, you know, really active.
The union membership was at an all-time high at that time, the number of
members. Yes, after that signing of the contract, that was the highest time. And then I was assigned to go to Stockton and to organize the asparagus workers. Asparagus is one of the most difficult farm labor job, you know. You have to go early in the morning, you are already cutting this thing, and it's top labor.
Yeah, it's way down at your feet.
And if you go back and straighten your, you cannot go back again. You cannot bend again because it's painful. But you'll find that at that time still, there were 60-year-old Filipinos working in the asparagus. I don't know. They worked until they died. And very unfortunately, because they were as poor as when they came in.
And their health care probably wasn't prepared.
Nothing, no assets, nothing, you know.
The current union still owes you a great deal, I'm sure, in terms of where it is today. And you said Arturo Rodriguez is heading it up, and you feel good about where
it
is.
I feel good about it because what we fought for, he's still continuing with it. And of course, we are getting old, and we're going to go one day, and somebody young and reliable, you know, and the workers could relate to would be fine. And I think he's doing a good job. Also, the son of Cesar, Paul, is doing a very good job too.
The number of members is way down now from what it was. What are they going to do about that, do you think?
Well, we are getting more contracts now.
Oh, okay.
They're getting more contracts. But you see, unfortunately, the Teamsters came into the picture at that time, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they took over, they had signed agreement with the growers in Delano.
That's after a sweetheart deal, right?
Sweetheart deal. And then when the pressure was too much, they left it. So naturally, the workers were kind of, didn't want anymore to have anything to do with it. And the growers were given the opportunity to change their ways. So I don't know. I think it's very difficult to go into that again. But they're growing, and I'm glad. And they're not only growing in the sense of organizing workers, they're also growing in the sense of services for workers. Mm-hmm. That's important.
Healthcare,
and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And
that's important too.
That's important, very important.
Yeah.
Because people will say, what's the union got to do? No, but they are doing it.
As long as people see it as a direct benefit to them, they're likely to sign up. If it's like a card you carry, it doesn't mean anything unless you see that your wages are better or that your conditions
that
are better.
That's important to you.
Yeah, that's something that affects you directly.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's still a lot of workers. I think members more than 20,000, I think. That's what I was told.
But the same practices aren't as obvious, like where they're in the field talking to people from the side of the road. You don't see that as much. You see more.
Well, in the beginning of a strike, it is always like that. Mm-hmm. You got to talk to them and send them, bring them out and mm-hmm. harass the growers in the sense that they will, oh my God, I cannot pick my grapes or something like that. Or my crops. So that's the way. And usually in the early part of the strike, they will cooperate. The workers will cooperate. But if it gets longer and longer and longer, of course, they have to feed their family also. You cannot blame them.
Yeah. I was living in Eastern Kentucky when there was a coal mining strike, and it was the same thing.
The
longest it went on, the more people started to say,
we're going to eat, we're going to pay these bills, and we cannot do anything, and you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time and mm-hmm. just talking about this. I think it's an important history to get on tape and to tell.
Okay.
And I appreciate that you're willing to talk about it. And I think your book will also go a long way to talk.
Yes, I don't know. I'm going to find out maybe another year or so.
Well, I hope they get
it. I can get it out there right away, because this guy said, you know, we need to have your book out there.
Yeah.
It's important. It's one of the most important thing now, because first of all, you know, regarding the truth, what happened there, I'm the only one that could do it among the Filipinos now, because I'm the only one really left to say anything, you know.
Yeah.
And I want the truth just in there. And that's why Gilbert and I are very good friends also, and Dolores, and Cesar's brother, Richard.
You were at Cesar's funeral. That must have been a very sad time.
Which one?
His funeral, Cesar's funeral. You went to that?
I wasn't here. I was in the Philippines at that time. So it was very unfortunate. You know. But anyway, Cesar and I were very good friends. Mm. We went to the Philippines together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, one of those things, and Richard and all that. So. Mm,
yeah. Well, thank you so much once again. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, okay.
Turn this off. Save it.